Rather new for me to be up here, and I'm just not too good at it. I don't feel very comfortable up here. I'd much rather be out there. That was good. I think you could do better than that. It was my privilege to be able to introduce Nell Wings of New York, and she is in the service work at the home office in New York and has, I think, 30 years of service going on her 31st year. And she works in the archives. And I know I've heard a lot of archives, I believe it is, or I've heard a lot about her. Everybody tells me that she's just really one swell gal to be around. She's always laughing. Very friendly, and I finally met her today, about 15 minutes before she came up here. And I'm sure she's everything they say she is. I think she was started out as Bill's secretary and was a personal friend of Bill's and Lois's. So I'm sure that she has a very good message to give you, and I won't take up any more of your time because I think I can sit and listen and learn a lot from her also. Nell?
Mary, very much. And all these lovely people here, isn't it beautiful? Surrounded by loving friends, and I feel the same way from all of you out there, too. John B. especially. I'm so delighted I can't tell you about that. It's a spiritual experience for me. In many ways, because I've been there so long, and even a non-alcoholic, I feel comfortable and I feel all these loving faces here, I know them, and I feel comfortable with them, and they're old shoes. They fit so very well. So I particularly value having them up here today, especially. Well, this is certainly a different kind of program, and it's right in the middle of the afternoon. I want to time myself a little bit at 3 o'clock. And if any of you feel sleepy, well, this is the period when I begin to feel sleepy, nod your head, get up and walk around or whatever. I hope that the next few quarter hours, not too many, that'll be interesting, and I can't cover, certainly, everything that's happened in AA over the past 43 years, so I'll limit myself to one decade, really, only. But let me say what a pleasure it is to be here in Wichita this weekend with you, and I'm very grateful to have been asked. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to get together and see old friends again and to meet new ones and to share a little bit of the AA history. First off, though, I want to bring you greetings. I know many of you are familiar with the AA staff in the office, and all of them send love, and particularly Lois, who knew I was coming here this weekend, and Bob and Betsy Pearson. And most of you know that Bob is our general manager in the office, and he and Betsy, his wife, are Kansans. Is that right, Kansans? Born and bred. And when I told Pierce before I left that I was coming here this weekend, he said, "Oh, how I envy you." And I can assure you that he's your number one fan. And he and Betsy, I guess you really never get over the love and the comfortableness of your own home state. And certainly that seems to be true of them. Now, next I have to, this is just a little personal note, and there, just to tell you that there are some areas in which I can qualify. I'm a non-stop talker, and it really is a disease. I may start a new movement of some kind. But I really do. I haven't been out talking all that many times, but when I do, people have to tug at my coattails and say, "Stop, it's time." I talk over and over. And it happens, I never really seem to learn my lesson. There's a story, I hope you'll bear with me if I tell it rather badly, but it's a little bit pertinent, and besides, I want to tell the story anyway. It has to do with two Irishmen And they were watching a John Wayne film on television. In one scene, John Wayne was riding madly towards the cliff. Said one Irishman to the other, "I bet you 10 pounds that he falls over the cliff." "Done," said the second. And John Wayne did indeed run straight over the cliff. As the second Irishman handed over his 10 pounds, the first said, "You know, I feel a little bit guilty about taking your money. I knew that would happen. I've seen this film before." "So have I," said the second Irishman, "but I didn't think you'd be fool enough to make the same mistake twice." It's kind of a tenuous example, but in a way, if I'm fool enough to make the same mistake twice this afternoon, I hope John, preferably John, will pinch me, tug at my coattail to do something, and I'll get the message and try and stop. So first, I'd like to share with you very briefly what AA was like when I arrived at the office, or as Bill would describe it, life among the anonymized. I came to the Alcoholic Office, or the Alcoholic Foundation, as the office was called, in March of 1947, when the fellowship was only 12 years old. Actually, I was only passing through town. I had been in service as a spar in the Coast Guard during the war, and I had my GI Bill, and I guess I was a pre-hippie type or something. I wanted to go to Mexico, and so I came down to New York, and I thought I'd get a temporary job and go on about my business and become a famous sculptress, for which I had some talent. And, the idea was I wanted to become a famous sculptress. Well, I did get a temporary job, and here it is now 30 years later, and I never did get to Mexico, and I never did become a famous anybody, which probably is just as well, because I'm not sure that my humility would have been able to cope, or if I had the humility to cope with that. Anyway, in that year of 1947, AA was barely out of its infancy. The membership was about 40,000 people at that time. There were about 1,200 groups, about 20 hospitals, 30 prison and groups. And we had, surprisingly, I think, the message was carried into about 18 foreign groups, overseas groups. Not that there were big outstanding or successful groups going, but there were contacts. We were in contact with people, and I think that was a pretty lot of spread for that particular era. But it was 18. In our small three-room office in those days, which was located on Lexington Avenue, this is 415 Lexington Avenue, right across from Grand Central Station, we were 13 people, including Bill. We had two AA secretaries. We call them secretaries. We call them staff members now, of course. A bookkeeper, a shipping clerk, a file and records clerk, two typists, two stenos, and very importantly, a newly hired office manager brought in especially to shape up a rather freewheeling office crew who had seemingly divided up all the jobs among themselves and who turned rebellious at the first hint of discipline and who indeed quit en masse. This all shortly after I arrived on the scene. But I did get into some of the shenanigans that went on then. I swear to you that when I walked in that door of that 415 Lexington Avenue, it opened and I was met by a girl wearing a paper bag over her head. And I learned that this was Mary Lou, who was our office cut-up. And Mary Lou was followed most of the day by the shipping room boys. We had one, and consequently, most of us, when we had calls to pack packages, literature packages, people would come into the office and ask for literature. All the rest of us had to go down and pack our own packages because, I can't remember at the moment, was out following Mary Lou around the office. And there were many. I haven't time to go in the whole spread of the funny things that happened in the office in those days. It's a whole other story in itself. But it was fun, and those days soon disappeared as far as that laissez-faire attitude. Today, in contrast, and 30 years down the road, we are now some 80-plus employees, about 86, I think, including the grapevine, and we're all better disciplined now, I may add, occupying 3.5 floors. And it's incredible to realize that whereas 12 years it took 12 years to garner 40,000 members, Today it's estimated that about 100,000 members come into AA in 1 year. And that further, that it's estimated that the total membership is something maybe a million people. And I tell you, that's really enough to boggle the mind of a non-alcoholic. I just recently did a little calculation and concluded that the total office budget for 1941 will equal, hopefully, my annual retirement fund. So I'm not sure whether that means whether I'm going to be a lot better off than I thought, or whether the expenses for 1941 were pretty modest after all. But anyway, I could give you the figure, but I don't know if I want to know what my annual retirement fund is all going to be. Let me just try to recap the period, the history of that period for one decade, starting that took place when I first came to the office. In fact, the spread of that whole decade from 1945 to 1955. It was probably the most important and exciting decade era in AA history. It was a most productive one of AA growth and development I think we've seen yet. At the same time, there were years of crisis and crises. Ruth Hawk, whose name I think a lot of you know, she was the first non-alcoholic secretary in the office. In a letter to Dr. Bob in 1940, said it well, describing not only the situation in 1940, but forecasting conditions for the next 10 years, when she said, quote, "This fellowship is developing into a veritable steamroller, which is going in all directions at once." And things were happening, and there isn't time, as I say, to give you the whole history. But in the early and middle 40s, for example, attitudes and principles were being forged out of the experience of that first decade. Things like anonymity, group conscience, group autonomy, group unity. The book was earning money, and it had been for the past 3 years since 1942. The old debts had been repaid, this since 1943. The trustees were passing resolutions about making AA self-supporting. Indeed, by 1945, the annual solicitation of the Rockefeller dinner list had been discontinued because the groups were now beginning to support the office. As Bill said in April of 1945, quote, "It was a great day when lately the trustees were able to express our profound thanks to Mr. Rockefeller and other friends and tell them that no more contributions were needed. It meant that the foundation was no longer, to any degree, a charitable enterprise. From that moment, AA, nationally speaking, stood on its own feet, backed by the earning power of its own publications and the earning power of its 15,000 members," unquote. And that probably was, and certainly was, the most important turning point in AA history, the idea that AA was now entirely self-supporting. And 1946 and 47 were also very, especially busy years. The public became much interested in AA, and over succeeding years, probably six Hollywood companies were inquiring of the office how we could cooperate with them in making motion pictures. And one by one they were coming, and it was a even when I first came, this was going on, and I think we were still negotiating with Hal Wallace Studios to do a picture. It took place over several years, and probably it was sparked by the success of the 1940 film, The Lost Weekend, which I'm sure all of you have seen, and which really gave a clear picture of the alcoholic, a true picture that had not been done before. And anyway, Hollywood was beating a path to our door. And there were several good radio programs on AA, including Cavalcade of America and We the People series. And as a matter of fact, I think, what is there in Kansas City? Is it KCKN or KNKC? Something like that. Well, there was 35 years ago, I guess. There was that station was putting on programs on alcohol, on AA, initiated by local AAs. And this was multiplied all over the country, and it was a very exciting, even Ask an Alcoholic was being done very early on. And there were excellent documentaries on AA, made by the March of Time, called Problem Drinkers. This brought in a lot of members, and RKO Pathé Film Studios did a series called This is America, of which the segment on AA was called I Am an Alcoholic. These two were very important, and they were being shown and rooted around the group, the areas, as subsequent documentaries were, even down to this day. Time magazine carried a good article on AA, as did the Reader's Digest, and that latter article bringing in over 3,000 inquiries over the next month alone. Many articles and newspapers and magazines were writing about AA, and it was really a fast-moving and a very exciting time. Besides that, Veterans Administration was opening its doors at its hospitals to AA, and also the medical profession was beginning to move towards declaring alcoholism a disease, as it did in 1956, and it moved towards that all the time in its subcommittee on alcoholism. And of course, we got the Lasker Award in 1951. And inside AA, headquarters suggested that intergroups be established for those localities having many groups. And Bill was writing the traditions, and these were being published in the grapevine. And the grapevine itself was losing its local character, its local flavor, and was becoming to be thought of as a national or international magazine of the fellowship. And out in the group themselves, members were beginning to reach out to the community to extend and their concern to the suffering alcoholic beyond the limits of their own group. Many people like Dick P. in Cleveland and Frank M. in New York were making translations, very good translations of AA literature, these in Spanish, and others in Cleveland and Chicago were making translations in Lithuanian. French, and so on. Members were participating in programs about AA offered by the local radio stations and publishing their own pamphlets and so forth. And while the groups were multiplying at home, AA was expanding steadily overseas, as well as developing rapidly up and down the American continents. Also strong beginnings in Australia, Hawaii, New Zealand, Ireland and England, South Africa, Mexico, Finland, Canada, to name a few. And lone members were touching and changing the lives of suffering alcoholics. There was Captain Jack S., who I was just in touch with just recently, who was established the Internationalists, the group of seamen. And he was carrying literature in the ports of call where he visited and leaving behind books and pamphlets and potential members. American servicemen stationed overseas were doing the same thing, building up, for example, I think I can remember in Germany. So much of it was started, groups were started there by American servicemen. And this was multiplied in Tokyo in later years and Korea and all over the world. And American servicemen really carried the message, AA servicemen, of course, I mean, carried the message far and wide in those days. And it was a very thrilling thing. And all of these loners and individuals were following in the footsteps of Irving M., who, like Johnny Appleseed, was scattering the AA message up and down the eastern part of the U.S. And also John P., who I think many of you maybe not remember, who was another Johnny Appleseed. And he was very active in this area. And that's why I wonder if some of you might remember him. And actually, speaking of the beginnings of groups, they were quite, you had, your state is one of the earliest AA areas in the country. There was activity, we had correspondence with inquirers as early as November 1939. And there was activity and contact in 1940 and 41 in Wichita and Kansas City. And so there was a lot going on in your area, and John may remember a lot of this himself in the history. Now, I think this is enough to reveal that there's enough examples to reveal a picture overseas, overall, a very promising and exciting picture of AA's progress and growth from inside and outside the movement. But there was to emerge some disquieting signs that all was not as harmonious as could be desired. For one thing, a serious and unity-threatening controversy developed in late 1946 over implied participation of AA in NCEA, which became NCA, in their public fundraising activity. A public solicitation statement issued by NCEA hinted that AA would be one of the beneficiaries from their solicitation campaign. As Bill and Dr. Bob's name still appeared on the on their letterhead, there was a danger of linking AA to an outside enterprise, and of course, they quickly removed their names in connection with the council. To make sure that the public would clearly understand AA's policy, the trustees issued a press release and another one about a year later, carefully defining our tradition of no endorsement and no solicitation. But there was a great uproar out among the groups, which wouldn't really subside for another 3 years, and in fact, the debate over the role of individual members in the alcoholism field and how far and how much AA might cooperate, if at all, with other alcohol programs continues down to this day. And I imagine and dare say that that's one of the most divisive or the most argued problems or facts out among AA groups today. And things weren't exactly quiet out in the groups either. For example, founders were often a problem. Many retained a tight grip on group affairs, causing restlessness if not outright rebellion. As a matter of fact, this was one reason how, in one way, how AA began and how it, by splits and groups, the many times it was over the founder, local founder. And this meant that another group would be formed, possibly a third group, and so on and on. But this, so it was beneficial, you might say, even though almost in, I can't tell you how many localities this occurred where the founder got beat over the head. In later years, Bill was too wisely, I think, say to the as many founders as he wrote to get on the sidelines and stay there, because if you didn't, sooner or later, himself included, you might be forced to. And clubs represented problems, and there was often dissension. Many maintained slot machines on the premises, and these got raided regularly. Nobody quite had a handle on how they should be operated, even though Bill wrote a lot about their place in AA over the years. And in the clubhouses, there were boy and girl problems. And this was always very disconcerting. And also, wives were in many areas causing problems, and they were said to be, quote, interfering. And were some areas suggested that they meet by themselves and form their own groups. And famous personalities, also members, were breaking their anonymity all over the place and defying anybody, including Bill, to do anything about it. So it seemed that in many instances, the traditions were being broken almost as soon as they got written. And also, editors of local newsletters and books and pamphlets were proclaiming in print their own interpretations of AA customs and principles, upholding these as the only true and right ones to follow. Several of these over the years were controversial, and the uproar over them took quite a while to subside. So it's no small wonder that one of the first actions of the first General Service Conference, when it began meeting in 1951, was to define and approve a new category called conference-approved literature. Now, I'm sure that most of you are familiar with the larger events of AA history, and realize that one of the most decisive and crucial periods of this decade we're talking about was the conflict between Bill and the trustees about establishing a General Service Conference. To begin with, in 1946, Bill at headquarters, having completed and published in the grapevine a code of tradition to ensure group unity, now began to work on a code of tradition for the restructuring of headquarters, defining its place in the movement, and this was followed by another plan about a year later, the most controversial part being the suggestion for the creation of a General Service Conference, which would form the linkage between the group, the still rather unknown Board of Trustees, and the headquarters itself. It was felt that such a conference of representatives sitting with an annual meeting would become the voice and conscience of the movement and provide the moral, if not the legal, leadership and guidance of AA upon the death of its co-founders. And very importantly, would also bring the trustees into regular contact and a direct relationship with the society, thereby ensuring at all levels communication and responsibility to each other. And correctly, Bill felt this would correct a serious flaw in the structure as he saw it at that time. Of course, as it turned out, Bill was the only one who thought so, and he soon found out. At this time, the board probably started a bill because of Bill's writing and his stirring things up, you might say, had began debating its own role in the movement. And there was, on the trustees at that time, people of institutional type background, business background, and the thought was, on most of their parts, and apparently the AA trustees went along with this, of having the groups do their 12-step work, do their own thing, so to speak, and they, at the top level here, the trustees, they'd take care of the money, they would do all that needed to be doing at that level, and apparently didn't think it was terribly necessary that the two of them should get together or the groups should be informed of what was going on. It was kind of a paternal, father knows best attitude, and this was a very serious debate that was going on, a passive role or an active role in the movement. The acceptance of his plan was urgent in Bill's eyes because Dr. Bob, by the late 40s, was ailing, and it was almost a certainty that he hadn't much time left. This caused Bill to press even harder, and his frustration at their reluctance to even try his ideas resulted in many hot and bitter debates. And the harder he pressed, the farther they backed away. And so there was a bewilderment, mutual suspicion of each other's motives. Bill felt they wanted him to be only, quote, a spiritual symbol and placed on a salary and so in an ivory tower where he wouldn't stir things up among the group. He felt that between himself and the trustees, there was what he called, quote, a preacher-trustee relationship. He felt bound to retain his independence and work towards refining the structure and putting his ideas into effect as he had planned. Of course, as Bill himself came to realize when he was able to look at the situation more clearly, his two-year depression contributed a great deal to the aggressiveness of his own behavior vis-a-vis the trustees. And he came to feel that he was attempting to direct the fellowship out of frustration and the need, as he put it, quote, for spiritual conquest, unquote. But there is no doubt that Bill, as always, had a vision of direction for the fellowship, which others didn't particularly want to share or follow, and it didn't at any given point, but at which, at some time later, did indeed prevail. I used to, Bill, many times when in the conferences there were arguments going and whatnot, and he would say, well, they can't beat the old man. And he said it lovingly. He didn't say it out of an ego or anything. But Bill felt always so strongly at what he considered the important things for AA. He could let you have your way and your say at anything below what he considered was absolutely essential to the survival of the movement. And he did appear to be, I'm sure, aggressive and arm-twisting, and I can attest to that because in later years, I always went up to Bedford Hills, first it was to work with Bill because he liked to work up there at home. He came down to the office very seldom, only about a day or two a week. And I still go up to see Lois about every third weekend, so I've been doing this for many years. But in later years, it got to be to keep them company because Bill had somewhat retired. It was just generally his correspondence to take care of. And he was a conservative New Englander. And I'm kind of a liberal Democrat, I confess. And so we used to have arguments over politics. That it used to be I'd shudder when the news would come on because Bill would turn to me as if I were personally had done some of these things he disapproved of. And then we would argue. And the next morning at breakfast, he would say, oh, we treated poor Nell so badly, and he'd apologize all over the place. But I got a good sense of this, of his backing you into a corner with arguments and whatnot. But certainly, I think we can all agree that nearly every one of his ideas prevailed and were for the good of the movement, right down beginning with the writing of the 12 steps and the traditions, the conference, the books necessary, the ratio change, and other structuring things that he did for the Grapevine and for the office. But the conference proposal wasn't the only suggestion in these plans of his, going back to his codes of 46 and 47. There were many ideas, some of which involved ideas, refinements for fiscal policy, including plans for creating a sound reserve, financial reserve fund. Another part called for improving and making secure the Grapevine position, and still another call for a closer linkage between the headquarters and the Grapevine staff and the board, giving the staff representation at board and committee meetings and a voice, or as we say now, an input, at policy decisions and authority equal to their responsibility. I have to say that these were years before Women's Lib, and I fear the board could rightly be called the accused of male chauvinism. In any case, there seemed to be a line of resistance on the part of most of the trustees, not all of them, but majority, to having Bobby and Charlotte, the two AA secretaries at the time, be present at board meetings or committee meetings, even as observers. Since the staff had all the experience, the day-to-day responsibilities for supervising the office, but not privy to the decision-making process, until the policies were passed down to them, there was a lot of conflict and frustration inherent in this situation, too, especially as they had to deal with increasing inquiries from the public, from the press, from publicity angles like the movie situations that I was just citing, magazines, newspapers, because this was a very busy time in this area. So they found it very difficult. These things got resolved, and they were, later on, the staff was allowed to be present at board meetings and at committee meetings. So nearly all these policies, we do have now a good sound reserve fund. We have a pension fund, as I say, and these were dreams of bills that would someday come to fruition, and indeed they did. Anyway, the debate about the conference proposal continued right through 1950, causing increasing concern and distress, with most of the board members threatening to resign, and many did, but they all later took back their resignation. There was one abortive attempt to stop the conference proposal in 1950 by a committee of three. They called themselves the Orthodox Group. They not only abhorred the idea of any conference, maintaining that there should be no leadership at all by anybody or office, and that God would be their sole source of inspiration and guidance, as in the Oxford Group, the OG groups. At least this is the lady on the committee who was a non-alcoholic thought. But they firmly believed that Bill had finally gone mad. He'd gone insane, as they really suspected all along. As it turned out, when they circularized the groups via a long letter stating forth their views, very few groups shared their views, and so they discontinued their efforts. But it was not amusing, but it was really a very stiff opposition. Thank you. At that time, so at last, this most serious and abrasive conflict was resolved, with Bill finally winning the approval of Dr. Bob and the majority of the trustees to his plan. And so the board, at its meeting on October 1950, empowered Bill to proceed to organize the conference along the lines proposed by him. So in April, the first conference, or panel one, took place in New York City. And the full story can be read, of course, in AA Comes of Age, in Bill's own words, on pages 210 to 215. So that whole five-year period had been a time of confusion, turmoil, frustration, bewilderment, hurt feelings, and by 1951, Bill could truly say, I'm sure, with relief, that AA had survived a very dangerous period, and the movement had come out of its infancy and was about to come of age. Other important events, of course, should be noted at this era, too. It was during one of his trips in 1950 that Bill became very much aware of how many family groups were in existence. They were called auxiliary or associate groups then, as you Al-Anons well know. We had been keeping lists of them. I guess there are about 100 or less than 100, 80 or 85 by 1950. And we had been just servicing them with the AA literature and pamphlets and put them in touch with each other, writing and that kind of thing. And when Bill returned home, he suggested to Lois that these groups ought to be gathered together into a fellowship of their own, and persuaded Lois to head it up. So the Al-Anon Family Group headquarters was formally established in 1951, and we all know that how fast and far it has grown over the past years. And I'm sure that there is an Al-Anon Family Group, one or more, in every place where AA is today all over the world. Also, during this time frame there, Bill was writing for the movement, publication of the 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions in 1953. These ran originally in the Grapevine. And the Works Publishing Incorporated, which is a business entity, changed its name to AA Publishing in 1953. And the Alcoholic Foundation, and I still kind of call it, still call it the Alcoholic Foundation, or I call it the Foundation, because it's a habit, it's out of nostalgia and love. And it changed its name also in 1954 to the present name, the General Service Board of AA. I often also say headquarters. Bill always said headquarters to the end of his days. And it's just something I say. And in that article in the Grapevine, I got a letter just absolutely blasting me, saying, what did I mean using that terrible name, headquarters? We'd abandoned that long ago. And why was I bringing it up again and starting to use it? And I hope I wrote back lovingly and said that, in the context in which I was writing, it was called the headquarters, it wasn't called GSO. So there is, and Lois tells me that Al-Anon had the same problem to face when it was originally called the Al-Anon Family Headquarters, I think. Was that the first name of it? And that they had to drop the headquarters also for that same reason. So there's a lot of feeling, apparently, about the use of that word. And during these years, of course, there was establishing of the first international conventions. In 1945, there was one in Cleveland, which was quite a big one. I think there were about 2,500 members, and three overseas countries were represented. So in a way, that one really ought to, I suppose, join the ranks of being an international one. But the first one to be called was in 1950, and of course, it was at that occasion that the traditions were formally accepted, the short form of the traditions having been written and modified or put into its short form in 1949. And this is accepted by the whole 50 conference for the whole movement, convention for the whole movement. And of course, at the 50 convention saw the last appearance of Dr. Bob, and he died later in that year in November, making his last appearance. I thought it was so interesting that when Bill died in 1971, he made his last appearance, and I don't know how many of you were there, in Miami, and almost apparently the very same way. I missed out on Bill's last appearance because I spent the whole day with Burn Smith helping him do his speech that on Saturday, and I was so exhausted that I slept in on Sunday morning, and Bill, I had to spend some time with Bill during that time anyway because he was sick and couldn't leave the room very much, and we only left really to go to the doctors and back again. And Lois was so busy with the Al-Anon sessions, and it was, I don't know how she survived that period or the subsequent period that next year. It was I tell you, that woman is gutsy. That's all I can say. She's made of steel. Really is. And I think Ann Smith was too. Well, I'm going, this is what happens if I don't have something in front of me. One thing leads to another and I go on and on. Anyway, in 1955, Bill was preparing for the second international in St. Louis, where he formally turned over leadership of AA to itself, the leadership of its affairs to the members themselves. And that was a very moving experience. And in It wasn't really, though, until 1962. It's kind of symbolic in 1955 because he still had some refinements that he wanted to do about the grapevine and that sort of thing. But in 62, he really did resign, and I use that word in quotes, of course. He came down to the office. We kept up his correspondence until about the time of it, until he died, or within 6 months or so, until he got very bad. But he went into other kinds of activities and got into things that he himself felt deeply about. Other things that I'm sure all of you may be acquainted with, the vitamin therapy and all of that. And I have heard people come up to Bill and say, thanks for saving my life twice. His activity in the area of emotional problems was very intense and very meaningful to him. I think so many years say 20 years or so, that when he first wrote LS, which became a letter, which became known as the pamphlet, it was first a letter in the grapevine, I can't remember what the name of it was now, but it became the pamphlet, Problems on, what was it, on Emotional, oh, isn't that fun? I can't think what that pamphlet is. Problems in Emotional Stability or something like that. You know the one I mean. And really from that time, he helped enormous amount of people, AAs and non-alcoholics. And he truly, that may not be so well known, but he certainly contributed a great deal of time and thinking and solutions to the emotional problems, because he had so many himself. As you all know, he had a period, which I think is fantastic, that whole period I'm talking about, 45 to 55, he was in the middle of depressions, really difficult depressions, some of them very intense, and yet he accomplished more for AA during that time. And I always think that's so remarkable, and he often thought so too, that he was able to cope and continue. So he had difficulties. So anyway, to review, the 1940s were years of initial beginnings, experimenting, developing, growing, and maturing. It was a decade of spreading outward. It was a time of change and creation, of keeping in touch with headquarters and seeking guidance from the office. And it was a time of establishing the structure and traditions. And if there was also lots of fussing, frustration, ego power driving, short tempers, but high hopes, I guess that describes most AA of AA still today. In the 1950s were years of consolidation of patterns and customs being established and defined. Groups and members communicated with GSO, not so much by the long newsy letters anymore, but secretaries wrote more business-like letters, carrying orders for literature, giving changes in group information, group officers, and so forth. So GSO, as its name got changed in about 1958 to GSO from headquarters, became more of a real service office and less of an advisory entity. So the traditions were set, the conference was established, and Bill was writing for the movement. To carry it on a little further, by the 1960s, other general service offices were proliferating among the early AA centers around the world, and literature distribution centers opened in Central and South American European countries. In South Africa and Germany and Ireland, England, Australia, New Zealand, India, there were general service boards that were being contemplated, or they were either also beginning to be well organized, as well as annual general service conferences, so that our experience has been duplicated now all over the world. And I think an absolutely fascinating and thrilling development has been the formation of the World Service Meeting. The first one was held in 1969 in New York. They're held now every 2 years and alternate times in New York. The last one in New York was last year. The one before that was in London, and 2 years hence, that meeting will be in Finland. It's really, it boggles the mind, you know. I hope you realize that this is happening. It's really terribly exciting. The whole pattern of experience is spread all over the world, and you are not just here and in a group by yourselves. You are represented all over the world, in India. An interesting little sidelight. I'm going to break in, I know, and I'll probably never know where I am later on. But an Al-Anon gal this summer was traveling up the Amazon in company with a tour, I guess it was, and their little boat stopped on a side of the Amazon going way up in one of the little branches and whatnot. And it was a little settlement, I guess, or it was a, anyway, there was a guy sitting on the bank. And as they somehow got talking to this fellow. And I forgot what he's doing with his painting or what. Anyway, Alice, I think it was her name, was talking. They got to talking anyhow. The way that she expressed herself and the phrases she used, he said, by any chance, are you an AA? It turned out he's an AA member. And so they had a marvelous little meeting right there all by themselves. And there are just hundreds of fascinating stories like this all over. So there, everywhere you go, in darkest Africa and in darkest Amazon, up in Thule Air Force Base, down in Ross's Point in Antarctica, Japan, Korea, all over the world. What are we, 98 countries. And I think that's a terribly, where will it all end? It just goes on. And the next decade, well, of course, the growth of the fellowship over the last 5 years has been so phenomenal. That's really another whole story all by itself. But certainly can be anticipated continuing and expanding growth, attention and consideration to our place and role and cooperation in the whole framework of community resources and programs to help the suffering alcoholic. We might have to be very attentive, we should be, and we'll have to be very attentive to the needs to protect the integrity of the traditions, with special focus and attention on anonymity and sponsorship. These are two very potential Achilles heels that could start, possibly, God forbid, but the disintegration of the movement and have it go the way of the Washingtonians. But let's hope that things don't settle down too routinely or dull, and I, for one, would like to have us retain a little bit of Ruth's hot steamroller, even at the risk of taking off in all directions at once. Let me take a little while to tell you about the archives. I'm the archivist at GSO, and I'm that because of my longevity and because I remember so much of the old days. I started, I guess, about 20 years ago. I was called a librarian. And Bill was always very interested in gathering history. And as a matter of fact, he took our office machine in the 1954-53 out to the early centers, Chicago, Cleveland, Akron, and New York, and taped a lot of early members. And these people are all dead today. And all these people from Akron, I have a much better picture of what happened in AA and of Dr. Bob in Akron than I do of what happened in New York. So it's so valuable to have a record of where it can be gotten and done soon, so you don't wait till the very last moment. We waited very late to get started with the archives, and so many people that I contacted had passed away. Two years ago, I decided I'd better write to Jack Alexander. And I sent him a letter, and his widow wrote right back and said that he just died. And I thought that was terrific of Anita Alexander to take time, really in the midst of her sorrow, to let us know. I thought that was a very considerate thing for her to do. I did the same thing to Gene Exman. I thought, gee, I'd better be writing Gene. You know, he's getting on. And he had retired from Harper's, if you remember him. He was the religious editor at Harper's and Roll Harper and Brothers, who wanted to publish the book in the very early days until before Bill and Hanks P. decided they had better publish it themselves, or recommended that they publish it themselves. But Gene was always a dear, good friend of AA, and I said, gee, I'll write him, which I did. And my gosh, I never got a reply.
And then I, knew why he had just died. And last year, a dear fellow in California, Charlie B., from the San Francisco area, had been trying to get a number of the old-timers together, those that were left. And so I said, well, I'd help him as far as I could. I couldn't really do everything. Couldn't set up the whole meeting out there for him, but I'd do what I could. And so I did a little research on how many old-timers were left. Would you believe that three old-timers had just promptly died that year, three of the really earliest ones? And there are still a very, you can count them on one hand, of course, but there are still a few that go back very, very early. And it's important to any area that wants to start the archives, like here, to get a good oral history started or preserve for your own setup the history of the people who started it and the stories of the people who started it. Anyway, we set up our archives by hiring a librarian to advise me on card cataloging and that. I'd had library work myself years ago, 1,000 years ago, and that's about really what wasn't what I was needed at this point. And I began going through the old files and selecting what should be preserved for the future. We set up an archives committee, which we still have, which is responsible and is a board. It is a committee of the General Service Board, and they establish policy. We have a budget. The idea of the main purpose of the committee is to keep the record straight, just in the simplest terms. This is what its function is, because things can get twisted. And there's so many versions of what happened in any given locality or in New York or by somebody out in the movement that it's important to get the facts down and have them straight. So the main purpose, as I say, is, as taken from our committee minutes, is so that myth doesn't predominate over fact as to historical accuracy. And speaking of myth versus fact, it's interesting to note that from ancient times, history books have often been considered to be a pack of lies, or as they've been described, as rivers of falsehoods. On the other hand, people might agree with Anatole France, who said that, quote, history books which contain no lies are extremely tedious, unquote. Hopefully, AA's history, when it is written, will fit neither description. Society's beginnings and growth is exciting enough, certainly, in this instance, without any outside embroidery. So what are the archives? Well, three categories, principally, are the basis. Bill and Dr. Bob's material, the group, early group history, and just arbitrarily, I picked dates from 1940 through 1945 as earliest groups, and the office, the records and the correspondence of General the GSO. These have all been microfilmed. They're placed in storage boxes in my little storage room, and they've been, as I say, they've been microfilmed. Everything eventually in the archives will be microfilmed and card cataloged. And so it's a really, I can only, I suppose, I'm over the hill now almost, and I suppose that it'll hope to set it up so that somebody else can take over and continue. Also, we're building up, as I said before, an oral history section. And as I said, that Bill had done a lot of interviewing with early AA centers. And very early on, I got together a list of old-timers and solicited them for their stories, and that has been, they've been very responsive, and that's been a very ongoing situation too. Also, replacing the old tapes that we've had in the office, including phonograph records and wire recordings, and retaping them onto a compatible format so they can all be played on the same machine. We have a very nice tape machine. And it's just helpful to have everything in the same format so it can all be played on the same machine. So microfilming, oral history, retaping. The other thing that we're doing is processing material that comes in from the groups, from all over the world, as a matter of fact. And it's just fantastic. It won't take time to tell you all everything that comes in, but every day something very precious comes in. And For example, one, it was a from George S., who was the husband of a very early gal in Akron, had in 1945 taken a little home movie of Doc Smith and Ann and Bill was out there and some of the early members. And it's only about a 5-minute little tape, but it's absolutely precious. You get a picture of Dr. Bob that you just couldn't get anywhere. And so I have that, and that was very generous of him to allow us to do that. It's irreplaceable. I mean, it's unique. There's nothing like it. So something comes in every day. So that's important and keeps us busy just processing and cataloging things that come in. Also, we're inviting countries and states to do their state history. And I'm sure that Kansas soon will be among those. If there's any help I can give anybody in doing that, I'll be very grateful to check the files and lend any assistance there. But originally, I wanted every group to have its complete history, and I was assured that was impossible. I couldn't manage that. It would take 100 years to get all that done. So the state is very important to show the growth, and for historians, when they write about a history, to be able to trace the beginnings and the growth in any state or states. We have researchers coming down. I have one currently writing he's a member, as a matter of fact, writing his PhD on the intellectual history of AA. And he's writing about AA in the big subjects, and the big comparing it with, say, in the Solonian philosophy and all that kind of thing. And it's interesting because another researcher is coming in, and it's going from the microcosm to the macrocosm. The other researcher, who is also a member, is going to take one state, New Jersey, and trace its beginnings right through the state level, right from group to group, and show, I guess, what the social factors involved were and the people. And anyway, he's pinpointing in a very minute way, whereas Ernie is doing this in a very big overall way. So it's kind of interesting. And that's why we want to be set up properly to help researchers, both AAs and the professional people, to have proper access to the archives and have them set up in such a way that will make it easier for them to do so. Lois has been marvelously generous in her material. In fact, just last weekend I brought back the tapes, cassettes that she did in writing her own biography. She is writing her biography, I think most of you know. And I'm so glad. I urged her to do this years ago. She's not doing it because I urged, but because she saw the need for it. Now Al-Anon did too. And it will be ready for Al-Anon's publication this fall. So she's been spending a lot of her time over this past year doing that. She has a writer, he's an AA member, coming up once a week, or twice a week, I think he comes up now, to assist her in editing and the format and all of that. It's all Lois's own writing, I can assure you that. So it'll be her own personal autobiography. So that's very exciting. And so Lois has given us, so I brought back the cassettes, four cassettes that she did as a background for that, and so that's very dear. She's given us some of the letters, copies of the letters, between herself and Bill when he went out to Akron. And I wish I could share with you a lot of these, because they're very interesting. It's a picture, a very intimate picture to be sure, of Bill and Lois at that particular time. And Bill tells about his first meeting with Dr. Bob, and you know, I thought the skies would open when those two guys met or something. It'd be a cosmic event. And not at all. Bill said, well, today I met a chap who has my problem. You know, it's just as simple as that. No great big event. And then he went to live with Bob and Ann for a short period, and came back in the end of August. We always thought it was September, but the dates say August. Of 1935. I came back to New York, I mean. Anyway, those copies of those letters and her diaries, which are very great, are very good, through 1937 through 1955. So she's been a very generous contributor. Before I forget it, I want to tell you that if you don't already know, some of you may know, we're doing a biography of Bob. And that's well started. And I've read the first 100 pages, and it's very exciting. I can hardly wait for it. It shows a picture of Bob that really we haven't seen before. I mean, it's great. It's just great. You know, I have to say that I'm so oriented towards Bill. I mean, I knew Bill. He did the structure. Bob was kind of like the figure of men, you might say, and Bill was certainly the maker of the net to catch them as they came in, and Bill was the architect of the movement. And I think because Bill contributed so much, he wrote so much, he talked so much, he built the movement, protected it, its survival. And I think we tend to forget, I think I do, how important Bob was in those days, his advice, his counsel, his steadiness. It's another long story to tell you about those two guys and their lives, and I haven't got time to go into that, but I've come to appreciate more and more how miraculous was the coming together of these two particular men and how they worked so closely together and solve problems between themselves. There wasn't a crossword, apparently. Bob didn't always agree with Bill in everything, but he was terribly loyal to him. He was always Willie, Bill was, or Sir William, and Doc was always Smitty or Doc. They had a very loving relationship. They were so completely different, and yet the qualities that each possessed was needed for the success of this movement. I think, looking back overall, you have to say that this is really a divine hand somewhere in the shaping of AA, the beginning of the shaping of AA. Well, there I go again. Let me just roughly, I haven't told you so much about what the archive outfit contains. We have, besides the group files, besides Bill and Dr. Bob's material, besides the foundation files, we have office bulletins and directories and conference reports and digests, and these have all been bound, and they continue to be bound. And these are primary source material. We have issues of the Grapevine, and of course from 44, they have a marvelous spread of history and information. And they're a great source when I need to check something. Printings of each pamphlet, you know, they were early on called can openers, and many of them, of course, have been in the foreign languages. The trustees and the AAWS records and minutes and records of meetings. I have a good picture file of Bob and the trustees, the early friends, conventions, places, events, and whatever. And film strips and documentaries, and I have a good tape cabinet. One thing I can't really do is take care of a lot of tapes, and they're fortunately, including your own right nearby, a good tape center, and two right nearby, as a matter of fact, and several around the country where I can refer people who need tapes of a particular person. About the only thing we can handle at GSL, because we just don't have room, are those that pertain to Bill or Bob or the early history of the movement. And there I'll have to refer others to our friends out in the movement. And then there is memorabilia like awards, the Lasker Award, citations, photos of historical places like Clinton Street and Beasley Street and Dr. Bob and Ann's place and so forth, and a lot of scrapbooks. And these have been, of course, also one big batch goes back to 39. And this has been a tremendous source of historical background. And people love to come in. They've been manhandled, but fortunately they've also been filmed. And what I want to do is laminate some of the earliest ones, the 50 and about 20 I have all together. And say from 39 to the present is a lot of scrapbooks. Currently I don't use scrapbooks. I use a big filing, a vertical file. And so these have to be also be photographed. It's a big process. It's a lot to do. So, roughly, let me tell you, bring this to a close a little bit. We have, besides the tape centers around the country, we're also having, I think, is a very exciting project of tape of archive centers opening up around the country. And I hope that Kansas will house Wichita or Kansas City or wherever will hold, start thinking about having its own archive center too, because it's it'd be very helpful and helpful too, because I simply will never be able to have everything in the office. And so many places, Southern California I'm thinking of particularly because I've just been in touch with them recently, has a splendid one going, and that should be very exciting to see that develop. And what can we hope to do to show the visitor at GSO? Well, we hope by visiting the archives, you'll get a sense of the whole expanse of the spread of the movement, the history, the pictures on the walls, studying, looking over the bulletin books and the scrapbooks and so forth, and see how many languages and the prayers and the steps and the traditions are translated into items in the display cabinet, storage rooms and the contents, the obit books, for example. I want eventually to, and I keep saying this and I haven't done it yet, to provide, have a tape of Bill, an excerpt of Bill and Dr. Bob, because many people have not heard Bill. So many new people coming in, to say nothing of Dr. Bob. So that will be something I will hope to do in the archives. So we want to give the visitor some new insight and appreciation of AA's beginnings and development, and an awareness that AA's history doesn't stop. It keeps on growing and becoming. Bill said it, and several other members paraphrased it in the early days. AA is not an achievement. It's a process, a continuing process. And so that's just about it. And it's getting, I can't believe it, an hour. So anyway, I will conclude by saying that here at GSO over the years, there have been many developments in the AA story inspiring to AAs and nons alike. And for me, a history teacher turned archivist, it's been and continues to be a wonderful privilege to follow at close hand the steady march of this fellowship over the world scene, making its influence possibly into the third and fourth generation of AAs now felt in AA today. I'm more grateful than I can say for the opportunities that have been mine, and for the precious friendships made, and for AAs touching the path of my own soul's progress. And one last thought. Thomas Carlyle said that, quote, history is the essence of innumerable biographies. And surely this is the truth of AA's history over the last 42 years. A history that, far from being dull or fabricated, is instead to thousands of people all over the world a moving testimonial to the triumph of the human spirit over fear, doubt, and despair. AA's archives contain a great many of these innumerable biographies, and I take great joy in being their guardian spirit. And I thank you very much.